Welcome to our podcast for Raising Arizona Kids Magazine. I'm Vicki Belint. Life was about to change for Dylan Francis that January 2012 afternoon. He'd been grounded for making some bad decisions, while his dad and stepmom Tara Hitchcock Francis, former host of Channel 3's Good Morning Arizona, were out of town. Remorseful about his behavior, Dylan did gain permission to go to a church-related event later that evening. During a game of Capture the Flag, Dylan suffered an arteriovenous malformation, or AVM rupture, on one side of his brain. 4 surgeries and months of rehabilitation later, Dylan, now a junior in high school, and Tara talk about what happened that day, the challenges of recovery, and what they've learned about life in the process.
I had turned 16 a couple months before. I would skateboard almost every day, blow off homework almost every single day, just try to hang out with friends, and I would also listen to music and DJ as much as I could.
So when you got to know Dylan, what was your first impression, Tara?
Well, I feel like I knew Dylan before I actually knew Dylan, because we waited a little while to meet the kids. My husband was going through a divorce at the time. We started seeing each other, so we waited. So I thought he was absolutely adorable. I could not wait to meet him. In fact, if it weren't for my husband, I probably would have pushed a little harder to meet them sooner. And when I met him, I just thought he was the cutest thing. I mean, he loves sports, and I loved sports. And gosh, he must have been in second grade or going into third grade, I think. And, you know, again, I feel like I knew him before I knew him. I remember he was real into Harry Potter at the time, and we had some things Harry Potter at the TV station, and I had, you know, my now husband give them to Dylan. In fact, Dylan actually remembers getting something from Harry Potter. He now knows that that secretly came from me. But I fell in love with them the minute I met them. And he's got an older brother and an older sister as well.
How old were you when you met Tara?
Around 6. It was second or third grade. I just remember what year in school I was.
And yeah, that's pretty close.
Yeah, and what do you remember about meeting Tara, other than she, like, gave you swag?
I don't remember much of it, but I remember one of my birthdays. It was probably my six-year-old birthday. I got a Harry Potter, like, gift junk thing that she got from the Harry Potter junket gift bundle. And my dad said it was from a secret friend, and me, my brother, and my sister literally sat down for an hour with my dad trying to figure out which one of his friends was it, because he only had, like, 5 friends.
And they were all guys.
That he talked about. So right. We were trying to, he would say no to everyone, and then we met her, and so, like, the first time I just kind of made that connection of, oh, she's the one that got me that Harry Potter stuff. That's awesome.
But was that
and
weird?
And then we also, not too shortly after, went to the Grand Canyon, I believe. Mm-hmm.
So you all have known each other for a while, so she's part of your life. So let's talk a little bit about what happened last year. It was January, and...
Okay, I actually got grounded right before this, if you want to add that in this. I don't know if you do. Severely grounded.
Before the event?
Like the day of.
Like an hour before it happened.
Okay.
And then I went to a church event, with a young men's event for my church, and we were playing Capture the Flag at Hopi Elementary School, and then... The roofs aren't very big, so me and my friend decided the best way to win was parkour and get on top of the roofs. So I was actually on top of the roof when I started getting a really bad headache and my left ear started ringing, like, beyond loud. Then the left side of my face started going numb. Then everything started spinning around me. And I had my friend who was right below me who saw me on the roof, who I've known ever since I can remember. I told him something was wrong, and I said, catch me. It was only, like, a 6-foot roof, but I was like, I'm going to kind of slowly slide off. I won't be able to catch myself. Catch me. And he did. And then I laid on the ground, had an anxiety attack like 5 minutes later. And then like 15 minutes later, I was throwing up. And then they drove me to Scottsdale and Osborne. They took a CAT scan and then they air vac'd me to St. Joe's.
So when you, did someone call 911, I'm assuming, or did they call your parents, or how did that play out?
The leaders called my mom, said that I'm feeling sick and they're going to drive me home. And then I started throwing up. And then they're like, okay, he should probably go to the hospital instead.
Do you remember being afraid at that time? You said you had an anxiety attack. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
I didn't really know what was going on at the time. I knew something was severely wrong. And I figured I was kind of close to dying, but I couldn't get a real grip of it. And I was kind of floating in and out of consciousness, if I wanted to say. Like, I was, when I talked to one of my, someone I know at my church who works at Scottsdale and Lawsbourne, they said I, on the coma scale, I was going from a moderate to severe to mild. I was floating all around. So I was, I didn't really know. When I was, like, with it, I remember kind of freaking out, but that was about it.
So it's kind of a, it's almost like a blur sensation.
Mm-hmm. In a way. I remember it happening, but I couldn't tell you every single detail. I can tell you the main details, but not the other, any other detail, really.
In some ways, that's kind of protective, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did it hurt?
I could easily say that was probably, well, it's a different kind of pain, but that was probably the most severe pain I've ever been in my life. It's a different kind of pain, though.
Jackhammer on your head? How could you describe it?
Well, the headache was beyond any headache I've ever had, so probably severe migraine. And then just the feeling of that, like, you know you're going through all of this and you know something's not working right, is even more painful, kind of mentally. So it was more of a mental pain than anything. And yeah, that hurt really bad.
Tara, where were you and what were you doing when you, how you found out about what had happened to Dylan?
It was a Wednesday night. Dylan had gotten into a little trouble thanks to a few bad decisions, and we had a big powwow here at the house. And in a very prophetic comment my husband made, that conversation started with, Dylan, tonight your life is going to change. And sure enough, you know, this is the night his life literally completely 100% changed. So we were sitting around the table. He left. We had allowed him to go to this scout event. It was the only thing he was allowed to do because he was grounded indefinitely at the time. And about not even 30 minutes later, in fact, he had just called me after leaving our house to apologize again. His mom called and said they took Dylan over to Scottsdale Osborne. And I said, what's the problem? And it sounded almost like he was dehydrated. And we thought maybe he's stressed about being in a little trouble. So sure enough, my husband didn't even want to go over there. He figured, let's just let his mom, you know, fill us in. And I said, you know, we just had this big, you know, united front that we presented him. Let's just run over there. We'll watch Modern Family when we come back, and then she can update us later. I got over there, and it looked like he had been drugged. I mean, he couldn't keep his head up. He couldn't speak. It was clearly something more than dehydration.
It must have been pretty scary.
I kept thinking someone slipped this kid something. I was just, that's all I could think about. But it was scary, but I also tend to go in a business mode if anybody is sick. I'm more businessy than I am a freaker outer, if that's even, that's not even a word, but I don't really panic. I just go into business mode. So I just wanted to find out what was wrong. They did a CAT scan and came back and said he's got a cancerous brain tumor. We're aerovacing him to Barrow. But I have to tell you, that didn't even faze me, because the minute I heard Barrow, I just thought, okay, good, now everything's going to be fine. It didn't even cross my mind that it wouldn't be fine. So sure enough, I texted a few friends that I know through St. Joe's and through Barrow and some of the charity work I've done, and I said, if we can get Spetzler, I want Spetzler, and you know, the whole thing. And it was just a whirlwind. We actually beat him to Barrow. We saw him being wheeled in off the aerovac. And the next day he had surgery, and that was one of several. And that night they did an MRI, and it turned out to not be a cancerous brain tumor. It was something called an AVM, which is an arteriovenous malformation.
And so, Dylan, what do you remember about finding out about your diagnosis? The aerovac?
I don't remember any of that. The second I got to Scottsdale Osborne, I remember getting out of the car, the door shutting, and that's it. And then I woke up
like almost a week. I mean, they medically induced him. They put him in a coma. So
well,
from
before,
that,
even before they put me medically
right
under, I blacked out. I woke up in inpatient rehab, neurological rehab. And the weird thing was, I had a taxi in my left hand. I could barely walk, and nothing really seemed to faze me. Like, it didn't seem like, oh, this is weird now that this is happening. It all seemed like, oh, this is reasonable that this is happening. So I obviously kind of knew that something was wrong, even when I wasn't awake, per se. And then when I found out what had actually happened to me, I figured something was wrong anyway, so it wasn't ever too much of a shock. But to hear that I had four brain surgeries instead of, like, one was a huge shock, because I never knew people needed more than one. And then also the shunt was a shock.
And you still have the shunt?
I do.
You can see it right there.
And will you have the shunt forever?
Or I'll have it forever unless I get a shunt infection. And then, I mean, they could take it out in a couple of years and I'll be fine, but it's just an unneeded another brain surgery. So they'll just leave it in unless I get an infection.
So, Tara, talk a little bit more about the diagnosis. That certainly is a concern whenever the brain's involved. Certainly during that time, you were probably thinking, are we going to get Dylan back?
Well, that was the toughest day for me was when they, you know, he's in the coma, he comes slowly out, he's got a breathing apparatus, and we don't know what he's going to sound like. Does he talk normal? Does he remember anything? What has he lost? And I knew, and the two things happened. First of all, the first words out of his mouth were, "Itch my nose." And then...
That's a good sign.
That was a good sign. And then... And it was hard to hear him. I mean, his, you know, he was very muffled, and I was right there when he said it. But the better incident was that same day, he had the breathing thing in his nose, and we had his arms kind of tethered because the tendency, if you just wake up, is to grab at things and you don't know what's going on. So I had talked the nurse into letting us untether one of his arms since we're standing right next to him, and they agreed. Well, sure enough, he pulls this thing out of his nose, and I try to put it back in his nose, and he goes, you're trying to kill me. I go, "Dylan, I swear I'm not trying to kill you. This thing has to go in my nose." And his exact words were, "Yeah, right, like the doctor's going to put tape on my nose. That's smart." And I thought, oh, we've got him back. This kid hasn't gone anywhere. But the other thing for me was just the music. His love in life is music. And for so long, he couldn't listen to noise. It was very painful. And I remember one day specifically, he was trying to listen to his iPod with his headset on the lowest of volumes, and he couldn't do it. And he was really frustrated, and he thought, you know, am I going to be able to listen to music? And that's probably the one day I got choked up at the hospital, thinking, oh, this, you know, he's got to be able to listen to his music. And I had the iPod in there. We had playlists for him while he was in the coma because that's his love. So I thought, let's put some Deadmau5 on. Let's get some of the stuff he likes, some Skrillex. But that day where I didn't know, will this kid ever be able to listen to music again? Will he be able to go to a concert again or DJ again? You know, that was the toughest day. And then, but they warn you with the brain, as you know, stimulus, and that just takes time. And, you know, thank goodness he's the age he is, because I know that helped significantly as well with his diagnosis.
So it sounds like your dad did make a prophetic comment in that your life was going to change.
Very much so.
Talk a little bit about how your life has changed.
Well, since January 25th, even though I was out of it for a couple of weeks, I've been in therapy for what is now 10 and a half months.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, pretty much.
So I have been in therapy every single day for 10 and a half months. For 46 days, I was in inpatient neuro rehab, doing rehab. Not as much, and then I actually got a couple days free, like 3 or 4 days free, and then I started at the new program that I'm at, where I went originally for testing, and then when testing was over, I went from 8 to 4 every single day.
What do you do in therapy?
I do speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and neuropsych therapy. And occupational therapy is for rebuilding the motor skills in my left hand. Physical therapy, I learned how to walk again without an assistive device. Speech therapy, we mainly just focused on being organized for school again, because that was our main goal ever since I entered the hospital, was we're going to get him back to school, we're going to get him back as a junior, he doesn't have to repeat sophomore year. And then neuropsych therapy is just, you know, the obvious therapy.
Helping you cope with what happened?
Yes.
How are you coping with what happened?
It's still weird. I mean, for about 5 months, I would wake up some mornings and feel like it had happened the night before. That was the hardest thing to deal with. I've gotten more used to what has happened now. It was hard when I had to use a walker and a wheelchair majority of the day. That really sucked, especially because my walker wasn't the greatest walker and make a lot of creaky noises. I think she can remember that because she's smiling about that right now. Yeah, the second I got off the cane, I actually went to California, and it was like one of the best weeks of my life. Like, so I don't know. I made the most out of my situation, though. I went to events, even with the walker, and made fun of myself with the walker. I put a hula scooter on the walker at one of these events and danced. So, I mean, I've actually used it to my benefit to have a more fun life, because I get invited to more things now, sadly, that's the truth. Now that I'm this, I've had brain surgery, I'm more popular. I wish that wasn't the case, but that is the case. I'm more popular.
Oh, he's milked it a little bit. It's a nice little.
I mean, but like, I wish I would have been more popular without having to say I had 4 brain surgeries, but that's the way I get to talk to people now.
Has it changed your perspective on life?
It has. I've told a lot of my friends to live their life a lot more fully, and every chance they get to do something, they should do it. Like, I talked at an event where the little things that I hated the most that I did with them, like for vacations, we hiked the Italian Alps. None of my friends would get that opportunity, and I was just telling all my friends, if you get the opportunity to do something like that, even if you hate hiking like I did, do it, because you never know, your life can change like that. Mm. And it did for me.
Well, and the other thing that's really amazing to me is Dylan's now in this outpatient program with a lot of other patients, ranging in age from, you know, almost 80 to, he's the youngest. Car accidents, motorcycle accidents, snowboard accidents, people in wheelchairs who probably will never get out of them. And it just every single week, in fact, Thursday is our relatives group day, so we just came from that today. And every single week I'm reminded how not only how lucky we are, because I look at him and you almost feel guilty reporting on his progress, because it's, you know, Dylan got to DJ an event and Dylan got to, you know, this neat article came out about Dylan. And it almost makes you feel a little bit guilty. But yet I've had the other parents come up and say, no, it helps us when we hear about Dylan's progress, it reminds us that anything is possible. So it's good for us to hear this. But the people that he's met that he might never befriend before this, he's now really good friends. And even his birthday this year, which was only not even a month ago, he said, hey, can I do my birthday down at CTN instead of at Brophy? I'd like to go down there. And they do kind of a big thing on a birthday. And he just wanted to be around the people he can talk about his brain hemorrhage every day and nobody gets sick of it there. Whereas in the real world, we all move on. You know, his buddies have moved on. It was kind of cool to hear about initially, but all right, now we're over it. You know, we've got our own problems. But at CTN, he can talk about it ad nauseum every day, and he's just like everybody else.
Tell me a little bit about how it's affected you personally, because I understand that you retired after doing your morning show for many, many years. The timing of this is really interesting.
My whole year, you know what though? It's funny. I've always been blessed by good timing, period. Whether it's professionally, personally, it's just been the one thing. But you're right. So here I am for 15 years and I decided to leave. Not retired, by the way, but I definitely decided to leave the station. Yeah. And go figure. You know, I decided to leave after all those years. And then the one time he's in the hospital for 46 days, I have nothing but time now to spend the day down there. And there's no way I would have been able to do that had I still been working. So it's been, again, I look at this as every day is a blessing. You know, you look back at 2012 and I think, what an amazing year for us. I mean, you know, in hindsight, if we could have the year without a brain hemorrhage, count me in on that. But I have to tell you, he couldn't have timed that hemorrhage better. We had the best doctor in the world for what he had. He's at Brophy with a better GPA than he's ever had at any school ever. He's DJing events. He's fun to be around. He's not grounded. I mean, there's a zillion things that I can name, timing-wise and hemorrhage-related, that just remind me every day that I am so lucky. And now we're getting ready to go out of the country again on our first big trip. Travel's my passion, and we get to do it with Dylan. And it's just, again, it's nothing but good. I get emotional all the time, but it's all like tears of joy. You know, we're in the hospital. I was just business and probably cried that one day with the DJ thing, and that was about it. I was all business. Nothing really fazed me. It's after the fact that I get choked up very regularly.
So what's the most helpful thing that people have done to support you after it has happened that you went through all of this?
Is a great question, and let me just quickly tell you why.
I hate to say it, but the best thing you can do is just get up.
Yep.
I knew that's what you're thinking. It's the one thing it was the last thing I wanted to do in the hospital. There, she'll probably tell you a story about it in a second. I think you know what story I'm talking about. But if you just get up, you'll progress. That was the last thing I wanted to do, like I just said. And I got up and I slowly learned how to walk again, which I would have never gotten up, I would have not had learned.
Well, what's interesting, and there are so many lessons that we've learned that any parent can apply to their child, whether or not they have any brain issue, I've seen so many parents, it's so tempting to enable your children. And there's a lot of guilt attached when you don't enable and you wonder what'll happen. I've never been the enabler ever. I'm the pain in the butt. I'm the one that gets on your case. And for my stepkids, to be honest, it's kind of been a blessing and a curse because, I mean, how many times have you been able to get away with stuff that somehow Tara doesn't find out? I've just got a radar for this stuff. And it's, I think about my role in their lives, and I'm sure I've added a lot of, oh no, man, if she wasn't around, we would have so gotten away with this. With his injury, he's right. You have to get up. So every day, I was the bad guy. And every day, he must have said, I hate you.
Well, you used my girlfriend at the time to get me up, too.
Well, hey, it's all strategy.
That was a story, right? Yeah. That was a story.
That was a story.
There's a lot of strategy when raising kids.
There's a lot of stories. But yeah, the main thing is just to get up and push through. The story that I was thinking of is, there was one day I didn't want to get up, and my therapist, like, they were trying for, like, I don't know.
It was a long time.
Like, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and they finally just looked at Tara and was like, all right, we need your help. Tara got me up, unwillingly by me. She, like, forced me up, and I would do this loop at the hospital, and I did the loop, and Tara's sitting on the other side, and my memory is terrible at this time. I don't even remember this, to be honest, except for what she's told me. And so she was thinking by the time that I would come around the loop and see her again, I would have forgotten that she was the one that pushed me through this. And I was telling her I hated her this whole time. And so I do the loop, and she's just texting one of her friends or something. And then right as I come up, she looks and waves at me. And the first thing, I just look at her right in the eyes and go, I hate you.
Yeah, I watched him. He left the room saying, I wish you weren't even here. I hate you so much. I go, I love you, buddy. Have fun in your walk. And I thought he'd forget it by the time he rolled around the corner. But nope. He comes back up, takes one look at me and says, I still hate you. You're the worst ever. And I go, well, I love you.
Yeah, but that didn't help.
It's okay. I mean, you got to have some thick skin, but it is. It was the best thing. And it is. It's hard to see someone that you love in pain, but when you know that it's the best thing for them, to me, there's just no alternative. And I was definitely the bad guy.
Yeah, I've learned that in my therapy. You see the people who just come into therapy and they don't want to work at my outpatient program, and then you slowly see them realizing, well, I got to work. And then once you see them come to the realization of I got to work hard, you just see them progress so much faster than you did when they were just negative Nancy,
yeah.
I guess.
And I guess that's kind of what she said about the relationship between the two of you and her urging you on. Would you encourage parents to stick with it? And because that's a tough thing to keep a relationship with someone who's been injured really badly. Mm-hmm. And you tend to want to comfort them and say, it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, in all the cases, I think parents need to be pushy in all the cases. Like, I'm going to get a lot of hate from my friends for saying this. Because if a kid can ever get away with doing something they're not supposed to be doing, it's most likely their parents' fault for not being pushy. There's nothing that me and my brother and sister could get away with without her finding out eventually. So we've learned that we just need to come clean, straight out of it. If we've ever done anything and we know she's going to find out, just come out. But, like, any case, parents just need to be that hard person. They also need to be nice when we need them and, like, we need to talk to them, which she is. But
aw, thanks, bud.
We also they also need to be that person that needs to, in my case, get them out of bed and get them to walk. They can't just be like the other person who's like, oh, you're not feeling well? Okay, well, just lie down and we'll tell therapy to forget it all.
Tara, what do you hope for Dylan for the future in light of
Oh, I'm going to get choked up here. I'm going to get choked up. Oh, man. You know, there's a... Shoot, I don't want to cry. I thought I'd make it through without crying. And then I get all squeaky, so this will sound really, really nice on the podcast.
Hi, guys.
Hi, everybody. There's a great line that I heard to describe someone else as a parent, and they said about this person, they don't have the courage to expect anything of their kids. And I think that's a great line. I think parents they've got to have the courage to have expectations of their children. And I remember one time Dylan said to me, this was actually before your hemorrhage, you just think I'm stupid. And I go, ugh, if I thought you were dumb, my life would be so easy. I go, believe me, it's because I know you're not that dumb that I'm getting on your case. That's, to me, the challenge of being a parent. It is the most frustrating thing when you want so much for them and you know what they're capable of. That's what's hard. So what do I hope for Dylan? I'm so proud of him. I mean, I can go on and on and on about what he went through and how he sucked it up. And I'm very hard on him. I was hard on him before this. I was hard on him during this, and I'm hard on him now. And he, not one time, and you started this interview by, when did you meet Dylan and what was that like? Not one time has he or my other stepchildren ever said, you're not our mom, not once. And that amazes me, honestly. If you knew more about our relationship, especially the one with Dylan, since he was the youngest, and I was so much more involved in his schooling and his upbringing than the others, that amazes me that not one time did he think to say, wait a minute here. She didn't have to tell me what to do. If anything, it's made us, I mean, it's been tumultuous at times, but I, you know.
Still don't know what that means.
Stressful,
said that twice today.
Up and down.
Don't know what that means. Said
tumultuous.
That twice.
It's like a roller coaster ride. Sometimes it's great and sometimes it's tough and one of those.
Okay.
But I have to tell you, when he called, you know, I feel like I'm the first person he calls when something big happens. I'm the first person he calls when he gets a great grade or a bad grade. I just feel so blessed to have this really cool, awesome relationship. But yet, like he just said, we're friends. But, you know, I am tough. And he responds. And
that's an understatement, by the way.
It is kind of an understatement. But I don't think, I would say, and you tell me if you agree or disagree, I don't feel like I have held you to a standard that you're not capable of. I don't feel like my expectations are so ridiculous. Is that fair? I mean, even the times where you thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this.
Sure.
Well, no, be honest. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't remember most of the time. But
see, sometimes he uses that when he wants to get out of
no,
really
like
answering.
I actually don't remember most of the times.
I keep going back to what do I hope for Dylan? I know what his love and his passion is. My only hope for Dylan is to apply himself and to do what he loves to do, and I could care less what that is, as long as it's something that really makes him happy and that he works hard for, that he's not lazy.
And what do you hope the future holds for you in light of what's happened? Has it changed your plans in terms of career or happiness or what are you thinking?
Honestly, when I was a while ago, like when a couple months after this happened, I thought that I would have to change my career because we heard so much about you can't be in stimulation. And my career path was music production and DJing, which obviously involves a lot of sound, a lot of lights, a lot of everything. And that's, for those of you who don't know, that's stimulation. And they said I could end up in the same state I was in the hospital, which was just a gimpy, lazy dude who was very sick a lot. And I didn't want to end up like that, so I was starting to try to think of other jobs, and I couldn't think of any besides, well, music production was kind of what I decided to do. And so recently I've been able to go back into music production, so job-wise it has not changed at all. Life perspective-wise, it has a lot, like I said earlier. I just would live everything up to the fullest that you can. That's all I really have to say. And then, yeah, I don't really know what else to say to that.
And his brain scan is actually his DJ logo. He's DJ Delirious, D-Y-L, like D-Y-L and Dylan, and his actual brain scan is his logo. So it all comes around. Yeah, he's very lucky.
More stories, community resources, and the most up-to-date family events calendar in town. Check it out at RaisingArizonaKids.com. I'm Vicki Belint. Thanks for listening.
This podcast was produced by Small Change Media for RaisingArizonaKids.com. All rights reserved. This material cannot be reproduced or rebroadcast without permission. Ooh.